Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of what is behind the changing political attitudes in the country on gay marriage and immigration. Princeton historian Julian Zelizer joins us to discuss his latest article at CNN, Generation X and Y Start to Rule Politics. Then we will speak with the former U.S. ambassador and CIA station chief in South Korea, Donald Gregg, who argues that rather than the show of force with B-2 bombers and F-22 fighters, the White House should be pursuing diplomacy with North Korea and negotiating a peace treaty instead of escalating the dangerous confrontation on the peninsula that could lead to a catastrophic war. Donald Gregg has an article at the Los Angeles Times, Reaching Out to North Korea. Obama showed on his Middle East trip the power of direct presidential involvement. He should employ the same sort of diplomacy towards Pyongyang. Then finally, we'll look into the murders of prosecutors in Texas linked to the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas and discuss the growing power and reach of this prison gang involved in racketeering, meth labs, and murder. Mark Potok, the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and editor of its quarterly investigative journal, Intelligence Report, and the Hate Watch blog, joins us to discuss what amounts to a declaration of war on law enforcement by the Aryan Brotherhood. Joining us now is Julian Zelizer, who is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's a regular contributor to CNN.com and Politico and has written for the New York Times and the Washington Post. His most recent books include Jimmy Carter, Arsenal of Democracy, The Presidency of George W. Bush, and his latest is Governing America, The Revival of Political History. He has an article at CNN, Generations X and Y Start to Rule Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Julian Zelizer.
Thanks for having me.
And in your article, you argue that the two new generations of Americans who have entered into their adulthood now in their late 20s, 30s, and 40s, they're starting to become influential, and Generation X, that's the Americans born in the late 1960s through the late 1970s. They saw the end of the Cold War. And the millennial generation, Generation Y, born between the late 1970s and the early 1990s, they lived through the communications revolution. So is this if I could tie this in, Julian Zelizer, to the recent autopsy by the RNC on what happened to the Republicans in the last election and how they can fix what they can see as a growing problem with demographics and the young. Is this essentially the case that both attitudes on homosexuality and immigration, et cetera, with these younger generations now coming of political age, are a kind of gateway to other issues, and the Republicans are basically losing these generations unless they deal with these gateway issues?
For sure. I think they might risk being out of touch, not just with younger liberals or younger Democrats, who they're obviously not going to get, but even younger Republicans. I mean, there's evidence that on some issues like gay marriage or immigration, that the stand of the Republicans on Capitol Hill doesn't match where a lot of Republican voters are of this age group. This is a generation that grew up where gay relationships were common in their families and popular culture. They grew up in a pluralistic country defined by ways of immigration. I just don't think these are going to be winning issues over the long run for Republicans, even if in the short term it helps the party gain a little traction.
Well, recently I did some coverage on the fact that student debt has passed the $1 trillion mark, second only now to household mortgage debt, and it's tripled since 2005. So something extraordinary has happened to the economics and the future of this generation, particularly the millennials. Do you think that not only are they going to get more engaged in politics, they're going to get more active because, you know, these for-profit colleges are a massive ripoff. The idea that you indenture an entire generation, burden them down with debts, give them worthless diplomas and no job prospects, that's never happened before. That's cruel and unusual punishment.
Yes. I mean, I think there's two different pressures. So on the one hand, the X's and Y's, the generation X's and Y's have grown up in an era when students accumulate massive amounts of debt, when job prospects are not great. A lot of the jobs that are good are still transitory. They don't have the kind of security that manufacturing jobs once had in the 40s and 50s here in the United States. And the prospects of doing better than your parents are not great. And so they are growing up in an era where this generation, the 20s to 40s, are ripe for some kind of political engagement. On the other hand, both the X's and Y's have grown up in an era where politics doesn't seem to work, where polarization is so strong and the power of interest groups is so overwhelming that Washington always seems gridlocked. That is normal for them. They don't have a yesteryear where politics seemed to work. And so those are two different pressures. On the one hand, there's reasons to become engaged in politics because of economics. On the other hand, many of them are disillusioned that politics can ever work. They've never seen that really happen.
Again, I'm speaking with Julian Zelizer, the professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He has an article at CNN, Generation X and Y Start to Rule Politics. So the fact that you have on the Republican side, the young people, particularly those evident at the recent CPAC conference, were largely the young libertarians, and the straw polls, Rand Paul won them at this current CPAC, and the previous ones, his father, Ron Paul, won them. So that indicates that on the right, young Republicans are turning to libertarianism. And I suppose on the left, you could look at the Occupy movement too. But they're both disgusted with politics for radically different reasons. The young on the left are disgusted with politics because it's run by money and special interests. But the ones on the right, the libertarians, are disgusted with government because they think that's the problem, as though living in a world controlled by the Koch brothers is going to be a paradise.
I think you're right. I think both sides have a certain critique of government, which, you know, we saw some of that in the 1960s, meaning the right rejected government for anti-government reasons, a rejection of the idea that government could do anything for the public good, an idea that markets were better. That's what the young right of the 1960s believed, and they fueled a conservative movement. And many on the left felt the same way for very different reasons. They believed that government was ultimately corrupt. It was dominated by big interest groups. And it led to an era where government has been on the defense for many decades. And there is some of that now. But it is interesting to see with some of these younger Republicans how they're not driven by these social and cultural issues at all. And they're almost trying to find some more pure form of conservatism, a dismissal of government and centralization altogether. I don't know how they'll do. The party elders still have a lot of power, but I think the party faces a tension.
So, Julian Zelizer, given what's happening with the burden of debt and the decreasing job prospects, particularly for Generation Y, what do you think in terms of political activism? Because there's a movement now called Money Out, Voters In, which was sort of in many ways was inspired by the Occupy movement. But their attitude was basically a plague on all your houses, you know, both on the Democratic and the Republican side. They've given up on electoral politics. Is there a way you think that electoral politics could be revived in the way, for example, that the Vietnam anti-war movement was a powerful political force? Of course, it went away when Nixon ended the war. But nevertheless, we've seen that before, and there you are at Princeton. So is your campus at some point or other in the near future likely to be inflamed?
Well, I don't know if it'll be inflamed, but I certainly hope that students don't simply remain disengaged from politics. I did have one very smart, talented student who came wanting to enter into politics, but the more he learned, decided there must be better ways to solve problems, because what he saw was that Washington wasn't working. But what you're saying is also true, in that there's all these fundamental problems out there, public problems that these two generations face, many of which revolve around economics, which I think offer the potential for politicians to make proposals, to put out big ideas about everything ranging from education to job retraining, that would really resonate for these younger Americans who are worried about their futures, and the older ones, Gen X, are worried about their families. So there's space to engage them, but I think it's going to take some politicians who are clever and innovative and some kinds of reforms of our political processes to really do this.
Well, but wouldn't it be better if the politicians came from the ranks of these young people as opposed to the older generation who are part of the problem pandering to them?
No, absolutely. And they will. I mean, Generation X is just in their early 40s, and this is the time, that's the age when you see people enter into politics. Many of them have started with their careers, and they're right at the moment when they can make the switch to the electoral arena. So that's what's going to happen now. Now they're making themselves known through public opinion, as voters, even as the leaders of interest groups and movements. But now this will be the generation of people running for the White House, running for Congress, and it will be interesting to see if they can translate some of these new ideas and this new generational approach to the political sphere.
So is it possible that we will have a kind of hybrid of social liberals and fiscal conservatives?
That's what some people say, you know, this will produce, and that would be a recipe that would work for the GOP. But I do think that does reflect certainly where a lot of younger Republicans are. They can still be attracted on issues like cutting spending or trying to make government efficient, but they want to leave alone some of these cultural issues that have been so central since the culture wars of the 1980s. So the party, you know, needs to listen if they want to remain relevant. The Democrats have done a better job already, not perfect by any means, but certainly Obama has done something to try to reach this generation, which he's really almost part of, the Generation Xers.
But does this generation need a leader?
They don't need a leader. I don't think you need one voice to crystallize everything this represents. I think they need politics to change. I mean, the most basic thing in how parties try to reach voters, it has to really start taking place through new mechanisms, not TV, not newspapers or even radio, but new forms of media from the internet to the devices of smartphones. I think, you know, it takes much more than one person to really reach an entire generation of voters.
But given that the Gen X generation saw the dot-com bubble burst and the Gen Y people saw the financial crisis, which has impacted them directly, are they likely to be economic orthodoxes? And you know, we've got this ridiculous sky-is-falling deficit argument that's going on now that makes no sense.
I don't think there will. I don't know what the orthodoxies will be. I think some of the old economic arguments, including this obsession with deficit reduction, short-term deficit reduction, might actually fall away. Even on that issue, you know, this generation, deficits are pretty common, and they've seen good times and bad times economically when the government's running deficits. So I'm not sure the 50s and 40s will care most about that issue.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Julian Zelizer.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Julian Zelizer, who's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's a regular contributor to CNN.com and Politico and has written for The New York Times, The Washington Post, and most recently his books include Jimmy Carter, Arsenal of Democracy, The Presidency of George W. Bush, and his latest, Governing America, The Revival of Political History. He has an article at CNN, Generation X and Y Start to Rule Politics. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with Donald Gregg, who argues for peace and peace talks with the North Koreans, not bluster and B-2 bombers.
This is where what is, and you say, oh my God, am I here all alone? But something is happening and you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones? You hand in your ticket.
I have always thought that it's a crime. Try to see it my way.
chance that we might fall apart before too long. We can work it out. We can work it out.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Donald Gregg, who was the United States Ambassador to South Korea from 1989 to 1993 and CIA Station Chief in South Korea from 1973 to 1975. He served as the National Security Advisor to Vice President George H.W. Bush from 1982 to 1988. And he has an article in Monday's Los Angeles Times, Reaching Out to North Korea. Obama showed on his Middle East trip the power of direct presidential involvement. He should employ that same sort of diplomacy towards Pyongyang. Welcome to Background Briefing, Donald Gregg.
Delighted to be with you.
And I've talked to a number of South Korea watchers and specialists recently, and there's a feeling that this time, in spite of previous rounds of bellicosity and a couple of real live incidents, the sinking of a warship and the shelling of an island, that this time around, one, the South Koreans may not turn the other cheek, and two, there's a concern that this young leader in North Korea has rhetorically dug a hole for himself out of which he can't get out unless he actually does something. So is that the dynamic that's at play at the moment?
Well, I'm concerned about those things. I am concerned at what the South Koreans have said in retaliation for anything from the North. I've always been concerned about how uptight the North Koreans get during large-scale training activities, which we undergo, and these are going to go on for the rest of the month. So I think the tension is high, and I think the stage is set not for a deliberate attack by the North Koreans. I don't think he thinks in that way, but I'm concerned about a mistake or a miscalculation that could escalate rather rapidly. So that's why I think it's very necessary for us to make some kind of a move toward a real dialogue. I met with the North Koreans quite recently in New York, and they said, well, we sort of, for the moment, given up on our diplomats. They were unable to stop the sanctions from going through the UN. And now all we're interested in talking to you about is a peace treaty. And there is no way we're going to give up our nuclear weapons as a price for talking to you. And you've got to talk to us about a peace treaty as we are, and that's the only way forward. And I think that's very difficult for Washington to accommodate itself to, because I think there's a coterie of people there who have built their credibility on pushing for regime change or saying that North Korea is going to collapse or that talking to them is rewarding bad behavior. And it's very difficult for these people to say, okay, we'll try one more time to talk to them. That's why I urge that there be some fresh thinking and some fresh faces involved in our North Korean policy.
Well, at this point, it seems that perhaps the opposite is happening from our side, given that the B-2 bombers flew over recently, and now the Pentagon's announced it's sending the F-22 fighters, stealth fighters, the latest in the U.S. inventory, to South Korea. So the question would be then, given that the North Korean regime has had sort of state-manufactured paranoia for some time, is that a mechanism by which the regime controls the people, or are they genuinely paranoid?
I think it's a bit of both. I think they are paranoid. I think the leaders of North Korea have used the threat from outside for generations as an excuse for some of the hardline policies they have taken domestically. And I think that they are genuinely concerned about us. And when they see our B-1 flying around and stealth fighters flying around, that feeds into the paranoia. And that's why I see this sort of escalation of tit-for-tat rhetoric for maneuvers or rhetoric for new weapons. It needs to be halted, because the tension gets higher and higher. I don't think Kim Jong-un is crazy. I think he has a greater sense of what the outside world is like than either his father or his grandfather. I think he desperately wants to talk directly to the United States. But at this point, there's a real relux- reluctance on our part to do it. I was just on the phone with Israeli radio. They wanted me to talk about North Korea. And I had seen a marvelous Israeli film called The Gatekeepers, which was, essentially an intelligence officer. I wound up as ambassador, but I spent 31 years with CIA, and I basically think like an intelligence officer. And I always think you ought to talk rather than fight. And I think it's very hard for the Israelis to talk to the Palestinians as their retired intelligence officers say they should. And I think it's very difficult for the Obama administration to get its act together and begin to talk to the North Koreans in the face of this blistering rhetoric on their part.
Well, I thought the most powerful thread through that film, The Gatekeepers, Donald Gregg, was that all of these former heads of Shin Bet all said the same thing, which is that Israel only has tactics. It doesn't have strategy vis-a-vis the Palestinians. So could you apply that to South Korea, that we're just operating tactically, whether it's George W. Bush's policy of basically finding them too distasteful to deal with, or what President Obama's people call
strategic patience,
exactly.
No, I don't think either of those really are what it's going to take to solve this problem. And it's we have a terrible tendency in this country to demonize those we neither like nor understand. I spent 4 years in the Vietnam War, which is a war we never should have fought, as we absolutely demonized Ho Chi Minh. Even with Saddam Hussein, who was a horrible man, we said, well, of course he has nuclear weapons, and of course he's in bed with al-Qaeda, because of look at all the other horrible things he's done. Well, he didn't have nuclear weapons, and he wasn't in bed with al-Qaeda, but that war was sold to us. And, you know, I'm already casting in my mind the cast for the film that will talk about the justification for a new war in Korea, and I have somebody in mind who would play the role of Douglas Fife, but good temperament keeps me from mentioning the name.
Well, let's hope that we don't get to that, but it does seem that the situation is extremely tense, and our escalating it with shows of force are not helping. Does it really come down to the fact that we simply can't swallow our pride and won't talk to this regime and essentially acknowledge its existence?
I think there's a lot of that. You know, I've spent so long in Asia, the problem of saving face is something that's always in my mind. And actually, I think the key player in all of this is Park Geun-hye. I think it's astonishing that one of the most chauvinistic societies in the world, i.e. South Korea, has elected a female president. And I know her. I met her years ago when I was there as chief of station. And she's a remarkable woman. And Kim Jong-il was talking to the head of South Korean intelligence and said, you know, I wonder if Park Geun-hye would come north and talk to me. And the South Korean intelligence officer told me, he said, well, you know, she's had a pretty tough run. You twice tried to kill her father, and then the second time trying to kill her father, you killed her mother instead. And the North Korean said, yeah, well, we know that, but we wonder if she'd talk to us. And so he said, I'll see. And she went to North Korea. And I encountered her at the opening game of the World Cup in 2002, and she knew who I was, and I knew who she was, and I said, I want to congratulate you for going to North Korea. And she said, we have to look to the future with hope, not to the past with bitterness. So she's a remarkable woman. And her new policy, I was in Seoul 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I met her new foreign minister, and he said, well, her policy toward North Korea is called trust politique. And he said she wants the world to know that's a direct descendant of Willy Brandt's Ostpolitik and No Taeyu's Nordpolitik. And she wants to build confidence with North Korea. So John Kerry, for whom I have great admiration, is going to go see her in Seoul in a couple of weeks. And then a couple of weeks after that, she's coming to Washington to see President Obama. And so I'm hoping very much that out of those two meetings can come a different approach to the North.
Again, I'm speaking with Donald Gregg, who was the United States Ambassador to South Korea from 1989 to 1993 and CIA Station Chief in South Korea from 1973 to 1975. And he served as National Security Advisor to Vice President George H.W. Bush from 1982 to 1988. And he has an article in Monday's Los Angeles Times, Reaching Out to North Korea. Obama showed on his Middle East trip the power of direct presidential involvement. He should employ that same sort of diplomacy towards Pyongyang. Now, obviously, if the White House is not taking your advice, and it doesn't seem to be at this point, then the last link between the North and the South is that sort of enterprise zone in the North that has had a number of manufacturing plants from the South and a number of South Korean workers there, and it's a source of hard currency for the regime. Would you see that then as closing down the final link, if that were to happen?
Yes, I think it's that's that caisson.
Yeah.
And there are under 1,000 South Korean workers there and about 50,000 North Korean workers there. And the fact that that is still going is, I think, of tremendous significance. And I think it is a signal that Kim Jong-un means what he says when he's working toward economic development of his country. Now, North Korea has got a lot of attractive options for foreign investors. It's mineral rich, it's water power rich, there are a lot of things that could be developed there once there was some sort of economic tranquility established. So I can't think of anything that would alarm me more than having Kaesong shut down. I would then think, well, they're in their tank and they've battened up the hatches and we're in for a hell of a fight. But they have not done that, and I hope to goodness they don't do it.
So in your op-ed piece, Don Gregg, in the Monday's Los Angeles Times, you talk about your experiences with the autocratic government of the father of the current president who you admired and who went to North Korea in spite of the fact that North Koreans agents had shot her mother, I think it happened in front of her, in fact, in an attempt to assassinate her father, that essentially you were able to stop the kidnapping of the North Korean opposition leader who the KCIA, the South Korean intelligence people, had put on a boat to nowhere. And you point out that rather than confront them directly, the ambassador sent a letter which gave them time to change their plans and essentially save Kim Dae-jung's life. He later was sent into exile here in the United States and then became elected president of South Korea. My understanding is that one of the problems in terms of dealing with North Korea from the point of view of the South has been that even with the sinking of the warship and up until the shelling of the island, which certainly got the attention of the South Korean people, but prior to that, the South Korean people had an enormous amount of sympathy for the North and didn't believe their own government because of these autocratic regimes that had preceded them. So is that still a fact?
I think it's a generational issue. The people who are my age and still remember the horrors of the Korean War are much less sympathetic toward North Korea than the younger people. And so it's a generational issue. But I think the matters you mention are very important because I've been to North Korea 5 times and I see the Koreans as pragmatists, and they don't like being cornered and they don't like being confronted. And down through the centuries, I mean, they refer to their own country as a shrimp among whales. And down through the centuries, when they've been cornered or confronted, they have fought their way out. Think of Admiral Lee Sun-shin and his turtle boat, who rallied and defeated the Japanese at the 1585 or something like that. So that's what scares me about our tendency to sort of drive them into a corner. I think that's very foolish of us. And, if by any chance a war breaks out in the Korean Peninsula as a result of this, the epitaph for it eternally would be, why did we fight them when what they wanted was a peace treaty? And I just hope that John Kerry, with whom I have met with North Koreans about a year ago, I think he's a very astute man. I think he's beautifully prepared to be Secretary of State, and I'm hoping very much that he will consider an approach that involves dialogue with North Korea, because that's what I need, what we need, in my view.
Well, apparently during the Bill Clinton presidency, things got so tense that Jimmy Carter, a former president, just simply went over there on his own with a CNN crew and essentially inserted himself in the situation to, you know, calm things down.
Well, that was in 1994. And the thing that saved our bacon then, we had reinstated the Team Spirit training operation, which I had suspended as ambassador, because when I was ambassador there, the first thing I did was suggest that we get our nuclear-capable weapons out of South Korea. And George Herbert Walker Bush, who I think was a magnificent president, took that as a sort of the start of a move to remove all of our tactical nuclear weapons globally. And that was, you know, a very important and very good thing to do. But we then reinstated the Team Spirit operation, and the North Koreans pulled out of the NPT and referred to turning Seoul into a sea of fire. And Jim Laney, who was my successor as ambassador, president of Emory University, knew Jimmy Carter very well, and he called up President Carter, who he knew had a standing invitation to go to North Korea, and he said, it's time for you to come. And so President Carter reached out to the Clinton White House, and the Secretary of State was very much opposed to Jimmy Carter going, but Al Gore thought it was a good idea, so off he went, and he met Kim Il-sung and had a very good talk with him. And actually, Kim Il-sung was preparing to have a summit meeting with Kim Young-sam, the president of South Korea at that point, when he died. And it's tragic that he died at that point, because had they had a summit meeting, I think a lot of this would have been avoided.
So what does that say, though, Donald Gregg, about our politics and the extent to which our presidents have dug a rhetorical trap for themselves, in as much as North Korea has been demonized for so long that talking to them would be a sign of capitulation and cowardice?
Well, I think Bill Clinton avoided that. I mean, he, at the end, thanks to wonderful work done by Bill Perry, his Secretary of Defense, he invited Marshal Joe Myung-rok to Washington, who went to the White House in full uniform and invited Bill Clinton to visit Pyongyang. And he wanted to go. He sent Madeleine Albright to sort it out. She had 11 hours of discussion with Kim Jong-il. And she said, I found him highly intelligent. But time ran out, and Clinton wasn't able to go. And then in came George W. Bush. And a year later, the North Koreans, having done nothing to deserve it, were suddenly cast into the pit as part of the axis of evil with Iran and Iraq. And the North Koreans have never gotten over that. I mean, when I first went there in 2002, they asked me three questions. The first one was, why is George W. Bush so different from his father? And I said, well, we're a big country, and, you know, George Jr. was raised in Texas, and his father was raised in New England. And then the second question was, well, how do you function as a country when you elect people who have nothing in common with their predecessor? And I said, well, that's the way democracy works. You have what we might euphemistically call continuity of leadership, so you don't have that problem. But we vote against presidents whom we don't like, and people come in who do things very differently. And they said, well, that makes it very difficult for a country like us to keep up with you.
Well, just in closing, Donald Gregg, what would you advise this president to do if indeed things are as tense and to some extent heading towards a collision from which we may not be able to retreat before a great loss of life? So,
I don't think it's quite that bad, but the way to defuse it would be for the North Koreans are very hierarchical. They get along with me pretty well, but they said, you know, you could come up here forever, but you can't solve our problems with your government. You're not high enough ranking. So I think the key would be for Secretary of State Kerry, who has a good credibility with them, were to send someone to them to say, look, we're ready to talk about a peace treaty. We want to avoid this confrontation, and we recognize what you're driving at, and so let's get down and get at it. But who he sends and whether, you know, what the Republicans, I used to be a Republican, and I've left the party. I wouldn't touch them with a 10-foot pole at this point. I think, you know, they are just would be dead set against anything like this, but I hope that President Obama and Secretary Kerry can be strong enough and sensible enough to realize that dialogue is the only way out of this confrontation.
Well, Donald Gregg, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it. Thanks for your good question.
Again, I've been speaking with Donald Gregg, who was the United States Ambassador to South Korea from 1989 to 1993 and CIA Station Chief in South Korea from 1973 to 1995. He served as National Security Advisor to Vice President George H.W. Bush from 1982 to 1988, and he has an article in Monday's Los Angeles Times, Reaching Out to North Korea. Obama showed on his Middle East trip the power of direct presidential involvement. He should employ that same sort of diplomacy towards Pyongyang. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the murders of prosecutors in Texas linked to the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas.
Walk away now, and you're going to start a war. We expected something, something better than before. We expected something more.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mark Potok, who is the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and editor of its award-winning quarterly investigative journal, Intelligence Report. In addition to editing the magazine and the Hate Watch blog, Potok acts as the key spokesperson for the Southern Poverty Law Center, a well-known civil rights organization based in Alabama. He's testified before the Senate, the United Nations High Commission on Human Rights, and other venues. And the Southern Poverty Law Center recently released a new report, The Return of the Militias, which documents how, after vanishing for nearly 10 years, the anti-government militia movement is surging across the country, fueled by fears of a black president, the changing demographics of the country, and fringe conspiracy theories increasingly spread by mainstream figures. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Potok.
Oh, real pleasure to be back.
And these killings of Texas prosecutors, first of all, an assistant prosecutor in Kaufman County was killed. He was fearing for his life, changing his routine. He was killed brazenly on the courthouse steps. And then after going public at a press conference, his boss, the district attorney, Mike McClelland, in effect challenged the killers, saying that they were scum and that they would find them in whatever hole that they're in, and we're going to bring you back and let the people of Kaufman County prosecute you to the full extent of the law. And then, of course, no sooner had he made those statements on television, he and his wife were murdered in their home. Most fingers are being pointed at the Aryan Brotherhood. Is that your understanding, Mark Potok?
Yeah, not the Aryan Brotherhood, but the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas, which is a distinct group. But, you know, what really happened was the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas is a white supremacist prison gang that was formed in Texas back in the early 1980s. The thing has grown into a major criminal enterprise. But in the last few years, there has been really quite a crackdown on the part of law enforcement on ABT, a crackdown that really culminated last November in a big racketeering indictment in which 34 ABT members were named, including four generals or the group's top leaders. So there's been a real effort to smash the group made. At the same time, the group has developed a reputation as arguably the most violent white supremacist prison gang out there. Its members have been blamed for the murders of over 100 people and as many as 10 kidnappings since they were formed. In any event, after this racketeering indictment of so many of its leaders last fall, the very next month in December, Texas authorities sent out a letter to prosecutors warning them that they had intelligence that ABT, the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas, was planning some kind of retaliation. What it was going to be was not detailed, and we really don't know more about it. But it was only a month after that that the first prosecutor, an assistant district attorney by the name of Mark Huss, was murdered as he got out of his car to go to work in Kaufman County at the county courthouse. Huss, it turned out, had been involved in some of the earlier ABT prosecutions. Then, not long after his death, there was the press conference you mentioned in which his boss, Mike McClelland, really said some pretty challenging things. And then, over this last weekend, almost 2 months to the day after Mark Huss's murder, Mike McClelland and his wife, Cynthia McClelland, were murdered in a similar fashion, a real execution-style murder. Their door kicked down. They were simply sprayed with bullets, apparently from an automatic weapon or perhaps more than one. So that there's no actual evidence in terms of forensic evidence other than the circumstantial evidence I've kind of laid out. But you can see why virtually everyone in Texas law enforcement is thinking that Aryan Brotherhood of Texas is very possibly behind this. And they're looking at them very hard right now.
Well, Mark Potok, apparently the first victim, the assistant prosecutor, Mr. Huss, he was shot the same day that two members of the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas, Ben Christian Dillon, known as Tough, and James Marshall Meldrum, known as Dirty, pleaded guilty of racketeering in federal court in Houston. So two questions. Are these guys flipping? Have they gone into witness protection? And two, what are these racketeering charges? Do they make money through racketeering, the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas?
Well, first of all, my understanding, and perhaps I'm wrong, is that they didn't plead on the same day that Huss was murdered. There was a Department of Justice press release which congratulated a number of people, including Mark Huss, for his role in these prosecutions of these two people. So I believe that's what happened, and it was just an irony because, of course, you know, immediately after Huss was killed, you know, people were wondering what in the world is, you know, where could this have come from? And then that came out right away, that he'd been named as having helped this major prosecution and so on. So I'm sorry, the second half of your question
What are these racketeering, these racketeering charges relate to what kind of rackets? How do they make their money?
They're involved in murders, attempted murders. A lot of that has to do with essentially disciplining their own members and frightening other people. What it's really in service of is an organization that's primarily involved in drug trafficking. ABT's big thing is running methamphetamine and heroin, and to a smaller extent, both cocaine and marijuana. And they're involved in, I think, any number of other kind of criminal schemes and so on, but that seems to be the biggest thing. They're big drug runners, and they've been involved in extortion, leaning on their enemies, extorting from prisoners who are actually in the prison system but not a member of their gang as well. So, you know, they're kind of a mafia, more specialized in drugs than anything else, but obviously a very scary group. I mean, you know, one of the details that came out last fall when these major indictments were announced was that at one point certain shot callers in the ABT, in the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas, had told certain members to go out and kill someone who they thought was cooperating with law enforcement. The killer was instructed by the gang's leaders to bring back the severed finger of his victim as a trophy. So, you know, that's the kind of group we're talking about.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Potok, as the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and the editor of their quarterly investigative journal, Intelligence Report. In addition to that, he also edits the Hate Watch blog. Now, apparently, in Kaufman County, where these prosecutors were killed, there are a number of meth labs, and that they apparently supply the Dallas area, which is, 20-odd miles away. How much of this is driven by the methamphetamine?
Well, I think a great deal, Ian. I mean, I was a reporter in that area many years ago, and I remember actually going on a tour. I was writing a story about crack cocaine and meth. And that is just the kind of area where methamphetamines are made. It's a very smelly process. The stink is terrible. So making methamphetamines is something that is generally not done in urban areas. It's typically done, you know, a little trailer out in the woods somewhere. And Kaufman County in that area is not heavily settled at all. There's a lot of empty land. You know, they're essentially working-class towns around there. So I think it makes some sense. And in fact, East Texas, which Forney and Kaufman County is considered a part of, is very much, you know, just thick with meth labs and methamphetamine in general. You know, methamphetamine has been considered for a long time kind of the white people's drugs. And it's also the drug that has been run more than any other by white supremacists in this country, both by prison gangs and white supremacists of various stripes on the outside. So that's kind of an interesting detail about that particular drug.
Well, there are reports, Mark Potok, that the Aryan Brotherhood, whether it's the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas or not, I'm not sure, were also involved in the killing of the head of the Colorado prison system, Mr. Clements, who was killed on his doorstep. And the person that ended up in a shootout with the police was a white supremacist gang member and of a different gang. But nevertheless, is there a connection then with what happened in Colorado as well as what's been happening in Texas?
Yeah, it didn't. What happened in Colorado, I think, did not have anything to do with the Aryan Brotherhood or Aryan Brotherhood of Texas that we know of. The killer, we know, or virtually know, was a man named Evan Ebel. I say we know who it was because Evan Ebel was killed in a shootout with Texas police 2 days after the murder in Colorado of the chief of the Department of Corrections. And after his killing, officials matched ballistically his weapon, weapon he used in a shootout in Texas, with the weapon that was that in fact killed Tom Clements, the head of the DOC, in Colorado. This guy, Evan Ebel, was a member of a white supremacist group called the 211 Crew. The 211 Crew, in the same way that ABT, the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas, is largely limited to Texas, the 211 Crew is a Colorado white supremacist prison gang. So they're different gangs. The question is, might these two regional white supremacist prison gangs, which more or less have adjacent territories and both are involved heavily in dealing drugs and very heavy drugs like methamphetamines, might they have been cooperating in some way? Might they have helped carry out attacks on law enforcement, who they obviously resented greatly, and who had led real efforts to crack down on the gangs in you know, the relatively recent past? That's what we don't know. There's no evidence to say that that's true. The intriguing details are the fact that Evan Ebel, who, as I say, murdered the chief of the DOC in Colorado, and then was killed 2 days later in Texas. Well, you know, the intriguing piece is that where he was killed in Texas was a mere 100 miles from Kaufman, a city which is the capital of Kaufman County. And, you know, that's not a terribly populated part of the world. It's about, as you mentioned, about 30 miles east of Dallas. But those are kind of wastelands out there. I know the area. There's not a lot going on out there. So it's a bit surprising that you would find him there. And the other piece of it is simply the fact that the FBI in Colorado has said that they are looking at the possibility of a link. You know, they've not suggested that they think there is one or that they have any particular evidence, but, you know, all of these events so close together in time and not all that far apart in terms of distance obviously has got authorities concerned and looking into it.
So, Mark Potok, how do these gangs like the Aryan Brotherhood operate in the sense that they mostly, from what I understand, just as also true of the El Salvadoran MS-13 gang, they seem to operate largely from prison, at least, you know, as much of their infrastructure is inside prison as it is outside. And you mentioned a bunch of generals were caught up in this big indictment that went down November last year, and that may have led to the shooting of both of these prosecutors, one of whom was congratulated for his role in it, as you just mentioned. I'm trying to figure this out. What is wrong with the prison system that would allow such violent gangs to essentially operate from inside custody? And when, you know, everybody says, well, we're taking the bad guys off the street. Well, you may be taking them off the street, but they might as well be in their offices.
Well, I think there are really two things going on. One is that as these gangs essentially age, we're seeing increasing numbers of them getting released, even at the end of very long prison terms, and being back on the streets. So Increasingly in the last several years, we've seen gangs that were formerly very largely confined to the prisons spilling out onto the streets, into our communities, and bringing all kinds of violent mayhem with them. The other piece of it is that it is true that the leaders of these gangs, by and large, are in prison more or less forever. I mean, the vast majority of them are serving life sentences for one crime or another. So you're right. I mean, there's something going on here. The fact is the leaders of these gangs are able to direct criminal enterprises in a very large number of cases from their prison cells. And that is true even in many cases where they're serving life sentences, sometimes even in solitary confinement. You know, what we know is that the gangs generally have devised very sophisticated codes, both verbal codes for talking on the telephone and written codes for letters. In addition, at least some of the gangs have used their women, their wives, their girlfriends, and so on to relay messages to the outside, and even in some cases their lawyers. So through a variety of methods, these guys are in fact able to direct criminal activity. You know, it's so bad that a few years ago, and this is the Aryan Brotherhood, not the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas, there was a major federal indictment of a bunch of members of the Aryan Brotherhood. This is in California. And what prosecutors said at the time was almost all of the people they indicted were already in prison, many of them serving life sentences. They were trying to get them the death penalty. And the reason wasn't because the prosecutors were so bloodthirsty. The reason was the prosecutors said they could not control these people in prison. They could lock them down in solitary and do all these things, and yet they were still doing things like ordering hits, ordering assassinations on the outside, and other kinds of criminal activity. So, I mean, I think that's an incredible story because it tells you that very serious prosecutors feel, at least in the case of many of these gangs, that they've got to kill the leadership if they're going to stop the crimes that they are directing, even from inside the prison walls.
Well, Mark, I remember many years ago where there was a horrible crime in Texas where a black man was dragged behind a pickup truck to his death. And the father of one of the young white guys that was responsible for this grisly murder said in defense of his son, he said, look, my son wasn't the same person because he was sent to jail for some minor delinquency, and the only way he could survive in the prison was to hook up with the Aryan Brotherhood to protect his life from other prison gangs, all of whom are based on along race lines, it appears, and that thus he was recruited into this psychotic, murderous gang.
And he was right. He was right. That did happen. With two of the killers, in fact, were in prison in Texas and did go in on quite minor charges, or relatively minor charges, and just as you say, were inducted into the gangs. And, you know, it used to be some years ago that prisoners joined these gangs simply as a matter of self-protection because you more or less have to if you're going to be in for many years. Otherwise, the likelihood of you being attacked or raped or even killed is really very high. So enormous numbers of inmates do join these gangs. In years past, it used to be fairly routine that, you know, somebody finished serving their sentence, they'd walk out and forget all about the Aryan Brotherhood or whatever gang it was they'd joined. That, I think, is less true now. As a general matter, the gangs are basically insisting that people stay in the gangs and continue to work for them. I know, for instance, that in the case of the 211 crew, the Colorado prison gang, that they actually have as part of their rules a requirement that when inmates are released who are a member of their gang, that they go out in the streets and, quote-unquote, start to earn again and return that money in one way or another to the leadership of the gang. So, you know, what I'm saying is that, yes, increasingly these guys are out there and really scary.
Well, they certainly have the prosecutors down in Texas quite alarmed, and they're all, of course, being protected by ATF, Texas Rangers, FBI, and local police. So Just in closing, Mark, though, this conversation's really turned more about our prison system in a sense, since that's where these gangs operate from and that's how where they recruit their members. What does it say? I mean, how can they call themselves the Department of Corrections? They're not correcting anything. They're actually, sounds like the school for psychopaths.
Well, you know, there's something to that. You know, to try and be fair to correctional officials, I think it's a hell of a problem for them. It's been incredibly difficult. They've tried very hard to tie down these gangs, to prevent them from running criminal enterprises, and they just haven't been that successful. You know, some of the techniques that are used by the gangs are really sophisticated. I mean, they have very elaborate, for instance, invisible inks, that kind of thing. So, you know, I'm not disputing anything you say. It's absolutely true. I mean, it's a scary thing that, you know, many times, or at least a certain percentage of times, you know, young people go into the prison system. They're not racist at all, or not particularly racist, and they come out as hardened race warriors, not to mention in the service of gangs that are really engaged in major crimes. So, yeah, I think it's true. I mean, American prisons are by and large not a terrific place to get rehabilitated.
Well, just in closing, though, does this tie into your recent report in any way about the growth of the militias?
I don't think so, because of the militias and the other groups on the extreme right on the outside, as you kind of mentioned in your intro, really their growth is being driven by a black man in the White House, the racial change that black man represents, the loss of a white majority in this country and so on, the very bad economy and all those kinds of things. I think these prison gangs live, you know, kind of exist in a universe of their own. I can't say. I think they probably have been growing, but I think the most noticeable thing is that their power is now extending onto the street, that they seem incredibly vicious, and if, in fact, any of these killings we're discussing turn out to have been carried out by prison gangs, they are incredibly brazen in a way that they haven't been in the past.
Well, if, for all intents and purposes, they're declaring a war on law enforcement.
I think that's right. I think if these really are assassinations, it is a kind of declaration of war. And we haven't seen the last of it.
Well, Mark Protok, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
A real pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Protok, who's the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and editor of its award-winning quarterly investigative journal, Intelligence Report. In addition to editing the magazine and the Hate Watch blog, Protok acts as a key spokesperson for the Southern Poverty Law Center, a well-known civil rights organization based in Alabama. He has testified before the Senate, the United Nations High Commission on Human Rights, and other venues. And the Southern Poverty Law Center recently released a new report, The Return of the Militias, which documents how, after vanishing for nearly 10 years, the anti-government militia movement is surging across the country, fueled by fears of a black president, the changing demographics of the country, and fringe conspiracy theories increasingly spread by mainstream figures. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.